A couple of the questions from the board were kind of directly related to the reflections that I want to offer. So I thought they're essentially about the same topic. The question this morning, I said, and I actually went back because one of the questions seemed to mishear what I said this morning. So I went back and verified what I did say on the tape. And so what I said this morning is, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. All conditioned phenomena are unreliable. All phenomena are not self. And this is what the Buddha, it says in the text, the first lines are sabbe sankhara, conditioned phenomena, anicca. I think this is what it is. Somebody could correct me on the Pali. Sabbe sankhara, dukkha. Sabbe means all, basically. So all conditioned phenomena, impermanent, unreliable. And then the third line is sabbe dhamma, anatta. All phenomena, not self. All dhammas, not self. And the questions are about this distinction, with the first two being related to impermanent, unreliable, being related to conditioned phenomena, and the third being related to all phenomena. What does that mean? What is that distinction about? So the key piece to reflect on, I think, and I think this is just, I'll try to keep it relatively simple. The third one, in contrast to all conditioned phenomena, brings in the question, well, what is unconditioned? If all conditioned phenomena are impermanent and unreliable, then what might also include unconditioned phenomena? Or unconditioned, this dhamma, it's not even phenomena, dhamma, experience, arising, whatever, unconditioned dhamma. And that is nibbana. So the reflection about impermanent, unreliable is related to the arisings of our sense experience, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, whatever arises in the mind. All of that is conditioned phenomena. Every sense experience, sense contact, impermanent, not reliable as a lasting place for happiness. Also, not self. Also, all conditioned phenomena, not self. But in addition, the Buddha wanted to highlight or point to that also this nibbana, and nibbana, this kind of may tend to incline us to almost create a thing out of nibbana, an entity or a, in just the way this is kind of brought into this discussion. But this is pointing to, nibbana in the suttas often defined as the absence of, it's not defined in terms of what is here, but defined in terms of the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. This is nibbana. And the Buddha says this, freedom, this cooling, the word nibbana meaning release, cooling, is reliable happiness. Elsewhere, he says it is stable happiness. And yet, what we think of as stable and reliable in our usual sense is some place where we're landing something. And I don't think that's what's being encouraged here, to have that sense or belief that there is a location of permanent reliable. It's more like the endless non-arising of greed, aversion, delusion. The non-arising is the freedom. The non-arising of clinging is the freedom. The non-arising of craving is the freedom. And so the pointing here, I think that this was in the time of the Buddha, this kind of sense of freedom being the merging of the self, or the merging with the larger self, the capital S self, or capital A Atta, that was where freedom lay, in kind of emerging into a stable thing. And the Buddha pointed out that even that freedom is not self. Even that, whatever that is, whatever nibbana is, it too is not self. So I hope that didn't just make it more confusing. So, a few reflections on cultivating the perceptions of impermanent, unreliable, not self. And this is just in general terms here, not specifically for each one, but just more generally. So first of all, it's helpful to remember, I think, that every experience, sabbe sankhara anicca, sabbe sankhara dukkha, every experience of body and mind is impermanent, unreliable, not self. We don't need to find a special experience in which to see these. Experience is never not impermanent, unreliable, not self. So while we may not recognize the impermanent, unreliable, not self nature of experience, it's not far at hand, not far from hand, in whatever is arising. And so just a few reflections on how we might begin to... So the Buddha used this phrase, cultivate the perception of impermanence, cultivate the perception of unreliability. So how do we do that? How do we cultivate those perceptions? And I, in reflecting on this, thought of three basic ways, and they're roughly kind of connected to whether it's possible to see this or not. And so sometimes we're not in the terrain of really seeing it. What we're seeing is what's in the way. We are seeing things as permanent, reliable, stable self. And so the one of the kind of hallmarks of not seeing these perceptions is that we're suffering. There's some kind of struggle happening. And so when struggle is happening, we are caught by the delusions of permanent, reliable self in some fashion. So when we can kind of use suffering as a guide, when suffering is happening, delusion is happening. The question, I think I mentioned this morning, the question, what is being believed when we are suffering, begins to point to some of these delusions at work. So what is being believed? The power of that question is that it can begin to reveal some of these deeper kind of delusions. It may also reveal the more personal levels of delusions, but it can point out just the mind kind of in angst, like there's got to be some place to land, someplace where happiness can be found. I want something to last, you know, almost this cry, this plea in the mind. And that being seen, having, you know, kind of hearing these reflections on the three perceptions, we can then recognize, okay, that is being believed right now. It's being believed that it needs to be stable. It needs to be permanent. It needs to be reliable. That's what's being believed right now. And perhaps we can recognize that as a functioning of delusion, but may not be able to let it go, but just recognizing it. So that's one kind of beginning way in to cultivating these perceptions is by noticing what's in their way, those beliefs of permanent, reliable self. And then kind of on the other side is that we can notice or become aware when these perceptions are happening, when the mind is oriented to noticing change, noticing the unreliability or not self nature of experience. Back to what I just said a few minutes ago about noticing when what's in the way. Sometimes the sense of suffering is obvious, and that is kind of our clue that there's delusion happening. And sometimes it's more the sense of identity that's happening that we're aware of. And so that's another thing we can notice. If there's a strong sense of self, a strong sense of I am, I need, I got to control or fix, that sense of self is also a pointer to that clinging to that delusion. So again, noticing what's in the way of recognizing the not-self nature of experience. So that's kind of the one side, is noticing when we're not knowing these perceptions, and then recognizing, yep, that's being believed. Mind is caught in that belief right now. And then on the other side, they're recognizing when those perceptions are available, when we can know impermanent, unreliable nature of experience. Sometimes the sense of self is not arising or falls away, and there's just this sense of, it's so many different ways we can be in that place. I don't even want to say an example. But some of you have described that sense of me not, this not, I'm not here. You know, it's just, and there's often a sense of a kind of relief or release in that kind of place. And then the third way is maybe, you know, right in the middle between these two, and that is cultivating or supporting these perceptions with wisdom reflections and with inclining the mind towards curiosity about the possibility of seeing them, inclining the mind towards noticing them. So the inclining of the mind can take different forms. We might just simply, and this is in the service of freedom. It's useful to explore this perhaps when there's a little more stability to the mindfulness. And so one way is, in terms of inclining the mind, is kind of just dropping in a kind of a curiosity. Maybe the mind can see the impermanent nature of experience, and then not trying to do it. We can't really try to do the seeing of impermanence. We can kind of ask the question, is this impermanent? Or maybe the mind can see impermanence right now. And sometimes the mind can open to that. Or if there's a kind of a pointing, this morning's reflection, the guided meditation, yesterday morning's reflection on the conditioned nature of experience, both of these in this terrain of inclining the mind towards seeing the conditioned nature, the impermanent nature of experience. For some of you, it may have supported that. For others of you, not. It doesn't. It's not always that the mind is in a place where it can turn towards that. So this kind of inclining the mind is almost just like dropping the possibility of seeing it into the mind. This morning I just kind of pointed to sometimes the mind can see the beginnings of experience. That kind of dropping in, it's like dropping in the pebble into the pond. It's like dropping the pebble into the pond, and sometimes there can be ripples or an experience that's related to that kind of inclination or suggestion. It's kind of like a suggestion. Maybe the mind can see that, and maybe not. So it's not, you know, it's not a problem if in inclining the mind in this direction, that's not seen. What my kind of interpretation of that is that's not what the mind is interested in right now. Maybe it's more curious about dukkha right now than it is about impermanence. Another reflection or way of inclining the mind towards impermanence is almost just more ordinary, at the ordinary level of experience. So this is kind of like just attuning the mind to notice when change has happened for impermanence. And this could also potentially be used for unreliability and not self as well. But as an example, Joseph gave the instruction on 1 3-month course to just notice change, you know, the change at the ordinary level, the change of the shadows as you go through the day, the changes in the seasons. And we were in the IMS in the fall, and we went from green through the fall colors through everything falling off, all the leaves falling off the tree, and just noticing this is change, reflecting, consciously reflecting on this is change. This is how a day changes. The sun comes up over there, it goes down over there. Really simple, ordinary level of reflecting on how change is apparent in our lives. So I was playing with this around my yogi job, which was veggie chopping. And, you know, just kind of doing this reflection, noticing, yep, there's vegetables there. And I was almost doing the reflection throughout the day. So there's these vegetables. They're whole, the whole zucchini there. And by the time I'm done with it, it's in pieces. Okay, that's change. At the reflective level, you know, it's not that I really felt the change of that zucchini, but it was a reflection. And then as the day went on, it's like I saw the zucchini in the casserole. And then, you know, there it's in a different form. It's cooked. And then I'm eating it and, you know, okay, it's going into a different form. And then later in the day, 2 days later probably, right? It comes out in a completely different form. Just reflecting on this kind of transformation of everyday experience. And one day I went in and, usually they had, the cooks had the things that we needed to do kind of stacked on the table. Sometimes they were in buckets and kind of spread around. And one day we were going to be chopping chard, and they had put all the chard on the table, not in buckets or round, but it was all entirely on the table. And it was like a mountain of chard. It seemed like it was probably 2 or 3 feet high of chard. I couldn't see across the table at my partners across the table. And my heart was just like, that is so much chard. We are never going to finish that. So my mind created this kind of thing out of that. And I kind of put my head down and started chopping the chard. And 30 minutes, 40 minutes later, I look up and the mountain is gone. That was a shock. In that moment, there was a shock. It's like, oh, there had been an attribution of stability to that mountain of chard. And now it's gone. It's not there anymore. So this is where that kind of curiosity about the reflection of changing things through the day kind of opened this mind into actually seeing how it had created a stability that was then seen for what it was, an idea, a concept. So that kind of reflection, just ordinary day reflection, can be powerful. With respect to impermanence, in particular, the Buddha does encourage us to reflect on the ordinary level of impermanence around aging, illness, and death, to use it as a reflection. That begins to penetrate the mind using that Suttamaya Panya, Chintamaya Panya, those levels of wisdom where it's not directly seen yet, but begins to penetrate, and then we can actually take it in at a deeper level. So that's a little bit about inclining the mind, using kind of just almost dropping in a kind of a request or a curiosity. Maybe the mind can see that. Or this kind of conscious contemplation or reflection, using our normal capacities of thought to reflect on impermanent, unreliable, not self. And then another piece of this that can support the mind, and this can be helpful when we're kind of hooked or stuck by something. We may be in a place where we're kind of able to meet something, be with something, able to notice it, and maybe we don't see the impermanent, unreliable, not self nature of it, but we can bring in actually wisdom reminders. Sayadaw sometimes calls this, we can borrow wisdom, borrow it from the Buddha, borrow it from our teachers, borrow it from books, bring in reminders about these perceptions. So we're witnessing a painful sensation in the leg, noticing that, noticing the aversion, perhaps a reflection on its impermanence. This will pass. Can help. It may not make you able to see the impermanence of that situation, but it may support the mind to be able to be more balanced. And so these reflections around these aspects of experience can support us. And finding your own language for this can be really useful. How do these wisdoms connect with you? So, you know, for me, some of the ways that I've used it, and I really encourage you to find your own language. You know, it will pass, you know. It's not going to last. It's impermanent. This is just. That one, for me, is more connected to the not-self experience. It's just self-hatred arising. It's not who I am. This is just a thought. So sometimes the phrasing of language for wisdom for ourselves can come when we have an insight, we have an understanding, and the mind, in having an understanding, sometimes will, not always, but sometimes will articulate that understanding in words. Now, the words, the articulation is not the insight, but it's a very natural process of our minds that when there's something that happens, that our mind kind of recognizes it, kind of pulls it into consciousness and frames it in language that the conscious mind can understand. And so that one that I just said, this is just a thought, that one occurred at one point in the seeing of the arising of a thought of self-hatred. And just witnessing that, seeing that arise, and just recognizing, wow, this is not anything. It is just a thought that might be believed. It has no power other than what the mind gives it. It is not self. But all of that understanding was collapsed into just that phrase, this is just a thought. And so that phrase, this is just, for the next like 2 days, I could just use that phrase and have access to that understanding. So the language, very powerful, sometimes connecting us through that language to the understanding. So reflections around dukkha, you know, this is suffering. That's actually a pretty powerful reflection at times. This is suffering. At Shui U Min, I was about 2 weeks into a 6 or 7 week retreat. My first time practicing with Sayadaw Utejaniya. And my mind was all over the place. It was miserable, uncomfortable, and my mind was comparing with previous retreats, saying something like, gee, about 2 weeks into my retreats at IMS, I'm feeling pretty good. This practice must not be working. All I'm experiencing is suffering. And that phrase caught my attention. It's like, as my mind was complaining, there was enough mindfulness to hear, there's a lot of suffering happening. It's like, suffering, right? That's what the Buddha said we're supposed to look at, understand. This is not a mistake. This is what my job is right now. And that just flipped the whole thing. It's like, right, okay, that's what's arising, dukkha. So that reflection or kind of acknowledgement or recognition, this is dukkha, can be very powerful at times. Instead of the believing the dukkha as being something inherent. It becomes the path that leads us to freedom from suffering. And then there's quite a few reflections related to not-self. I think I'll save those for now. I'll just name them. I won't just go into them so much, but in a day or two, I'll do a more in-depth reflection on not-self. This is nature. It's causes and conditions and unfolding. This is not mine. This is not who I am. This is not myself. That is the Buddha's reflection. He offers us over and over again in the suttas. He said we should contemplate, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Very much encouraging us to use this wisdom reflection. Another, it's all just process. Process is tumbling on. I think Munindra's was something like empty phenomena rolling on. Another kind of not-self wisdom reflection. So a little more reflection on impermanence itself. Go a little more into impermanence. This perception is so, it is everywhere in the texts and the suttas. So many different ways that there are pointings to notice the impermanent nature of experience. This will free your mind. This will serve you. At different levels, even the Buddha talked about these vast cosmic levels, saying, you know, eons of world expansion and world contraction, you know, that kind of, maybe today we could think about it as like the expanding and contracting of universes. Everything in the universe will come to an end. And so he points to impermanence at this level. And he points to it at the human level, encouraging us to reflect on aging, illness, and death. Both of these, I think, are really at the reflective level, although we can touch into very viscerally the truth of our mortality. And so those reflections can drop us into that as an understanding, as well as being reflections. And then there's the moment-to-moment pointing. And this is where the perception of impermanence becomes deeply freeing, because at such a microscopic level, we attribute permanence to so many different aspects of our experience, unknowingly, unaware that we're doing so. And so this process of becoming aware of kind of just this flow of experience, the nature of our experience at a very refined level, our mind begins to touch into and see at whatever level we're looking at. Yep, no permanence there. The mind may then kind of like look for it at another level. Well, maybe there. Nope, not there either. Maybe at another level. And basically, the Buddha pointing to nothing in experience, in this conditioned formation, is permanent. Every moment is new. And even as that moment is new, it's already vanishing. So there's a I'll just highlight a few kind of the teachings connected to impermanence. I can't possibly do them all. I went through some of the suttas this afternoon, just kind of looking for flavors of the teachings on impermanence. It's everywhere. So the main instructions on mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, with every contemplation, contemplating the body as a body, feelings as feelings, mind states as mind states, dhammas as dhammas. After every single mindfulness exercise, and these exercises can be understood in different ways. They could be understood as directing the attention to that experience, like the mindfulness of breathing part, choosing to tend to breathing, or choosing to attend to the elemental nature of experience. But it also can be understood as when these things are apparent, we notice them. So I don't feel like there's a conflict between how this practice is taught as a receptive practice and the Satipatthana Sutta supporting the awareness of the fullness of our experience, but with particular perspective. And that perspective very much emphasizing impermanent. So with every single one of these mindfulness instructions, there's a refrain that follows the instruction that brings in the contemplation of impermanence. And the word sometimes is translated as contemplation, but I think we often think of that word contemplation as meaning reflection or thinking about. But I think the word more closely means something like observing. Gil has pointed that out. He's the one that pointed that out to me. We did a retreat on the Satipatthana Sutta, and he said, let's not use Bhikkhu Bodhi's word here. It doesn't really map onto what the Pali means, which is observing impermanence. So the refrain goes something like, one abides observing in the body its nature of arising, or one abides observing in the body its nature of vanishing, or one abides observing in the body its nature of arising and vanishing, or one abides observing in feeling its nature of arising, its nature of vanishing, its nature of arising and vanishing. Whatever is being observed, it's just like keeping this perspective of impermanence in mind. Also in the Satipatthana Sutta, not only can that refrain, which is repeated many times over, so we get this continual like chanting of notice the impermanence, the arising, the vanishing, the arising and vanishing, but also in the fourth foundation, some of the instructions for how to observe feeling, the five aggregates, for example, the hindrances, six sense bases, includes a kind of specific instruction on noticing how, for instance, in the hindrances, how that hindrance comes to arise, how the non-arisen hindrance becomes arisen. So noticing the arising of it. How does that happen? That's part of the instruction. In the five aggregates, there's the encouragement to notice this is form, this is feeling, this is perception, etc. And this is the arising of form, this is the cessation of form, this is the arising of feeling, this is the cessation of feeling. So again, bringing this perspective, the encouragement to not just observe experience, but to bring this perspective in, which is a wisdom perspective. A wisdom perspective in terms of this is what will free the mind from clinging. Because as we understand the impermanent nature of body, the impermanent nature of feeling. The mind, understanding that, recognizes it's not reliable. It's not a place where I can land to find happiness. And so the mind begins to let go. Shariputra actually said this in one teaching. Somebody was asking him, so how do you recognize feeling as like not being delightful? And Shariputra said, well, when I notice the impermanent nature of feeling, the mind understands it's not a good place to find delight. And so it lets it go. And the last, oh no, there's two more I'll mention. I have a whole page of them here. I'll just pick two more. One, again, pointing to how these different perceptions interconnect. Talked a lot about the interconnection between impermanent and unreliable. Because it's impermanent, it is not a place where we can land for that lasting happiness. There's nothing stable about it. It will fall apart, and the happiness will also fall apart. To his son, he encouraged this contemplation of impermanence more to undermine the conceit, I am. He said to his son, develop the perception of impermanence, and the conceit, I am, will be abandoned. So that connection between the way in which we attribute a stability and the construction of a sense of self following off of that perception of something stable. And this kind of makes sense as we look at what's happening in our experience. In particular, we look at the sense of I am. We see that it's not stable. We see that it comes and goes, and that kind of begins to burst a little bubble of its kind of enduringness. It begins to be more understood as a process, a flow, a change of sometimes this is arising, sometimes it's not arising. Sometimes this other is arising, sometimes it's not arising. Again, that impermanent helping the mind to kind of poke holes in the belief of the stability of anything, including the belief in the stability of the sense of self. Because really the sense of self, that kind of belief in the sense of self, is a belief in some kind of permanent, abiding thing or entity that's traveling through time. And so as we contemplate the impermanent nature of experience, it undermines that. Where could that abiding entity be anyway? It's nowhere in this changing experience. And then another place where this contemplation of impermanence comes in, is in the Four Noble Truths. This is not perhaps obvious in the way the Four Noble Truths are usually translated. Often they're translated as the First Noble Truth, this is suffering. The Second Noble Truth, this is the origin of suffering. Craving is the cause of suffering. The third, the ending of craving, is the ending of suffering. So this is the ending of suffering. And the fourth, there is a path leading to the ending of suffering. Gill, to me, has made a very convincing argument about the translation of these words. The word that is translated here as cause is more often used in the Pali as arising. And the word for cause, which there is a word for cause in the Pali, but it's not used that much, actually. But it's used, but it's not used here. It's not used in the Four Noble Truths. And so Gill has pointed out that the second noble truth should be translated, "This is the arising of suffering. With the arising of craving is the arising of suffering." To me, that is much more in line with my actual experience. When craving arises, suffering is already arising. It's not like suffering is a cause craving is a cause and suffering follows. As soon as craving arises, suffering is arising. So this translation makes a lot more sense to me. And it's pointing to the arising nature. The arising of craving is the arising of suffering. Notice the arising. Notice the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. Notice the ending. So right in this very foundational teaching is embedded both anicca and dukkha, impermanence, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. With the cessation of craving is the cessation of suffering. So it's both an understanding of impermanence and also something about the conditionality. Conditionality, causality, sometimes people put those together. The conditioned nature of the arising, many conditions coming together, but a key kind of piece of that is there can be many things going on, but when that craving is arising, suffering is arising. And so that's kind of a key for us to notice. The arising of craving, the cessation of craving. So these reflections, I offer these reflections for inspiration, curiosity around this perception. But again, to just trust that this information will stick as it needs to, and you don't need to think about it or remember it or figure it out. Kind of a trust that hearing the condition, basically this Dharma talk is a condition. It is a condition that puts impermanence into the field. It puts this Dharma into the field. And your minds will respond to that condition in different ways. But you don't need to actively do something with it. I think like that Dharma rain, it just infiltrates and may kind of touch some kind of seed that will then sprout. And maybe not on this retreat, maybe 2 years from now, something from this might come to you. That happened to me on one retreat. I had had a retreat with Steve Armstrong, and he had said something to me in an interview, and I'd gone off and like tried to write down the answer, and there was a little reflection about it, but not much real understanding. And then a year later, I was in Burma, practicing, noticing my experience. And the instruction, what he'd actually said is, notice your relationship to dukkha. That was the instruction he'd given me. And that year later, I was sitting in Burma in the meditation hall, and I heard Steve say that in my head. And that was the perfect instruction for that moment. There was an understanding that happened in that moment. That's the way these kinds of talks can function. You don't have to hold on to any of it. So, a couple of questions. Yesterday, you mentioned this non-existent moment. Could you please clarify what you mean by non-existent? Is it that experience is vanishing so quickly, even as it arises, that we could say a moment doesn't exist? That's basically what I meant, yes. That there's no solidity to any aspect of a moment. It comes into being and it's here for a moment and then it goes away. You know, it's in some ways the understanding of impermanence kind of can have a little bit of a mistake around it. We can have an understanding around impermanence, like I did with that pile of chard, where it's like there was a thing there, and then it was like, it's not a thing, it's gone. Kind of a surprise that something vanished. So that can be an understanding of impermanence. And yet the deeper understanding is that there's not a thing there at all. There's never any stability in any way, shape, or form. And so that's what I meant, that, you know, there's no place to really land in a moment on a thing. There's no moment to land on, even as we're there, it's already shifting. And so the next part of the question is, then how do we contact the moment if it doesn't exist? How do we contact water flowing by in a stream? We're not contacting a piece of water. Put your hand in a stream and there's no thing there that's the water, this water that you're experiencing. It's moving through. So you put your hand in the water, there's kind of an immersion there. And there's no doubt that you know that it's water. Kind of an intimacy with that experience. That's the contacting of the moment. And that's the best I can do right now. Maybe just one more today. You've spoken about mindfulness not being strong enough to meet difficult conditions. Can you say more about wisdom not being strong enough when mindfulness is strong and meets beliefs and views that are fiercely clung to. So yes, this can happen, that we can be aware that the mind is clinging fiercely to a belief or view and not about to let go. The wisdom is not strong enough to see through it, to burst that belief or to allow it to let go. And yet there is at least enough strength of mindfulness to be present. Sometimes there's not enough strength of mindfulness to be present, and then we need to use our tools, shift our experience in some way. But sometimes we do have more stability of mindfulness, and we can hover with it. And so I think the question is, what might support the wisdom being cultivated there? Seeing the wisdom is weak, but there's a strength of mindfulness to be able to hold and not be swept away by the beliefs. There's enough awareness to recognize there is a belief happening. Well, first of all, I'd say that that is some wisdom. Even being able to notice this is a belief has wisdom in it, because it's at least not just believing it's true. So there is wisdom there. So let yourself, first of all, acknowledge that. You know, yes, there is some wisdom here. Maybe the mind is recognizing, yes, this is just a belief and feeling, and this is the dukkha of believing it. So these are kind of ways into touching that those truths. And then I think using some of those wisdom reflections can also support the mind to be able to maybe more easily hold that for a little while. So the mind is caught in this belief and if there's a sense of like a taste of the quality of the belief, in this case it sounds like there was a sense of what the belief was. Sometimes it's in that way that I said earlier, it's just like a screaming from deep inside the existential, this is not okay. That there's not control is not okay. That I can't be in charge of this is not okay. And so there's a sense or of a connection to what that delusion is connected to, which of these areas is it connected to? The desire for control, which is in the terrain of wanting, the clinging to self. Is it around not wanting suffering to be there, wishing for some kind of stability? So if you have a sense of where that belief is rooted, then sometimes you can drop in the opposing, like, wisdom. It's like, yep, this is not me. Even this wanting to control, that's not me, that's not mine, that's not myself. Or that kind of sense of, it's not okay, this instability, or wanting something to be stable. Just a reminder, that's truth, that it is unstable. That instability is truth. Sometimes in these beliefs that the mind gets so spun out about, you know, the mind is basically rebelling against the truth. It's unstable. That's not okay. It's not controllable. I don't have control. That's not okay. And sometimes the acknowledgement of, and it's true. That is the nature of experience. That is the nature of every moment. Sometimes reminding ourselves that as actually what we're seeing there is seeing truth, not a mistake. And sometimes that mind that goes, I'm not in control, it believes it should be able to be in control. And a little bit of that reminder, yeah, that's the way it is, can help the mind to, oh, right, it's not my fault that I'm not in control. It's not my fault that it's not stable. That's the nature of experience. So those are a few reflections there. Let's just sit for a moment.